Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
Tagging along as always, I'm Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the January 19th, 2026. Tom, what are you going to start out with this week?
All right. So the first one I'm going to come at is more driven towards a conversational piece, but I still think it's very interesting. So I have an article from Google called Closing the Door on NetNTLM V1, Rainbow Tables to Accelerate Protocol Deprecation. So Google's Mandiant unit publicly released a comprehensive data set of the NetNTLM V1 Rainbow Tables to highlight the extreme insecurity of that legacy authentication protocol and to really drive towards accelerating its retirement. Although NTLM V1 has been known to be weak for more than two decades, the protocol still really persists in a lot of environments. And we've, I believe, talked about this a few times in the past. And it really creates an easy target for credential theft and especially for lateral movement. By making these rainbow tables available, defenders can, you know, take this and demonstrate real world risk and lower that barrier for testing. But this is the part where I think it's you know, this opens up a decent conversation. The adversaries can also use them to more rapidly crack captured hashes. The initiative stresses that continued reliance on NTLM V1 increases exposure to authentication, coercion, and privilege escalation attacks, really, again, reinforcing the need to migrate to modern authentications types like NTLM V2 or even leveraging Kerberos more. So some of the bullet points here, the data set contains pre-computed mappings that allow for rapid reversal of those password hashes, marked in, you know, most cases in under 12 hours using pretty modest hardware, significantly lowering the cost of cracking those captured creds. It really highlights that the weakness of that legacy authentication protocol. Attackers will, you know, commonly force systems, to authenticate to a malicious listener, capturing those handshake responses. It's something that's pointed out in the article. Then those responses can simply be leveraged against that lookup table, that rainbow table, to pull that password hash. And once that's recovered, it's pretty much straightforward to lateral move, use it for authenticated access. Attacks like desync to extract even more credentials or escalate privileges. And despite being deprecated and insecure since really the 90s, NTLM V1 is still commonly out there and enabled in so many enterprise environments, really due to its legacy application compatibility and kind of the configuration, like I think inertia would be a good word to use. But yeah, Scott, this is interesting to me. And really the key point is not to necessarily harp on the NTLM V1, but my perspective in bringing, or at least one of the points I want to bring to kind of talk about and see what your take is I find myself really torn on how I feel about this. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, my history as a practitioner, and understanding some of the environments that I've been in before. And it's always easy on the forefront to say, you must, you know, we really need to upgrade to the new thing. We really need to push to the new version. We really need to make sure we patch, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And on the surface and then the dialogue that's usually out there in the public, that's usually the prevailing thought, just get to the secure version, so on and so forth. But environments are not that simple. And even though I fully support that idea, and I think we should do our best to try to be as fluid as possible to stay up to date on the you know, security patches, making sure we're not vulnerable, things like that. Environments are complicated, and a lot of environments require being able to maintain certain levels of operation for certain things. And part of that means overhauling a system takes a lot more time. And even if certain environments wanted to patch, even if they had all of the drive and the passion and the go-getter mentality to patch as soon as possible, in a lot of environments that still might require 6 months of planning, work, change control, you know, potential, you know, policy or or audit type stuff that they have to deal with. I mean, there's so many things to consider. So while I think what they're trying to accomplish is good, I kind of starting to find myself leaning from the middle to the, I wish they wouldn't have done this, because I feel like this may cause more problems than it is pushing forward the goal. You know what I mean? Like I sort of like cringe at it a little bit. I'm like, I mean, I get what you're trying to say, but it's kind of a heavy bat to swing, and you're potentially hurting a lot of people in the process. But, you know, I might be being a little too dramatic on that. I'll leave room for that. But it's just my assessment when I kind of read this, that I think this could have been done in a different way. But I'm curious what your take is, man.
Yeah, no, like I understand the hesitation, but, you know, I think you and I have both been in those conversations where if we stress that, hey, there's this security issue that we should care about, and people are like, I mean, it's not that big of a deal. And then you kind of have to prove it to them to say, no, it is. Like, look, we use this and this is what we're able to do. This is why we want you to like at least consider like tracking this, you know, and maybe you can't fix it kind of thing. At least draw attention to it. I think that's why, you know, proof of concepts for exploits come out, all that kind of stuff, which kind of can be beneficial and hurtful at the same time. With the Intel MV1 stuff, I mean, because it's so old, I think that's kind of why Mannion takes this stance, because it's like, you know, either you haven't really taken it serious, you're not looking into it, or whatever, it fell off your radar. That could be part of it. And also, I'm pretty sure there's other rainbow tables for this out there other than the ones they made, you know, easily available. So my assumption there is attackers probably have a, maybe not as complete table, but a table they could probably find and use. So, you know, there is that aspect. But it's cool for, you know, giving like the defense side, like an edge of understanding or whatever you want to call it. But I think they did it in the best way here if they were going to do it. And the reason why I say that is they do a good job kind of talking about it, giving some background. They kind of tell you how to do it. That may not be, you know, best defense versus offense. I mean, that's kind of both things there. But then they go into kind of going through the like remediation aspect. Like, how do you configure things so that it's not using it? What does the group policy look like? How do you identify this in your logs, in your environment? That kind of stuff, which I think is really good. Obviously, they could have had an article about just that, but since it's so old, maybe people wouldn't take it serious enough. But I have seen, like when I've come across Intel MV1 being leveraged, there is the legacy application aspect of it. But there's also environments that are configured where it's not, they allow Intel MV1. They're not necessarily using it. And there's a preference to not use it in the configuration. But because it's allowed, attackers can then use tools to say, I need to authenticate and all I can use is Intel MV1. So then it allows DCs and things to kind of roll back and use it. So they're able to take advantage of it, even if you don't have legacy stuff using it in your environment. And that's good to be aware of, too, like forcing it not to be there if you know it's not there. But then also some other remediations. Let's say you do have legacy and have to use it. You know, can you put those apps on a different VLAN so they're not like adjacent to things? The account that is using it, can you have extra monitoring on that? Or can you even, you know, make sure you're doing the right least privilege with that? Is there a way you can set up a DC in a special way so that it's the DC just for that Intel MV1 auth in that VLAN, so it's not kind of touching everything else the same and it's forwarding those auth requests? There's a lot of things to consider that you can kind of do even if you can't fix the problem, that may give you kind of a defensive edge. So I think it's really good, like, educational piece. And I think rainbow tables don't really get enough attention really anymore, because, I mean, if you think about rainbow tables, you know, this is Intel MV1. There's nothing to prevent rainbow tables to be generated on any of the other authentication hashing protocols, right? So, and you have to expect, that nation states, they have the capability potentially to brute force things, but they also have the capability to just generate and store that data for Rainbow Tables for other things too. So when people steal hashes, especially on their capability, if people aren't super familiar with what Rainbow Tables are, I mean, it literally is saying, I'm going to pre-compute how a password will be stored based on the method being used, so that it becomes just an Excel spreadsheet, to dumb it down, where I can look for that stored hash and see what password it is in plain text. And now I have the actual password that I can authenticate with any protocol, right? And I think that's why, even if you have a segment of your network that's using NTLNV1 and you have it segmented off, if someone knows that password, they can try to authenticate where NTLN isn't allowed, like the V1, because they have the password to do so. So it's just those considerations. I don't think they covered it in the same detail that I walked through, which I would love for them to have really got into the weeds. I don't know if people would be as excited about it, because it is pretty straightforward of an article. But those are the things I brought up, I think, are worth, at least thinking about, because there's, like you said, like, security isn't just as easy as like turning a light on and off, right? You have to really think about your solutions, think about your designs, think about what you're really trying to solve. What's the real risk? Like, it's just always this scale and balancing act. And how do you tip the scale in the right way in your favor?
Yeah. It's, it's all great points, Scott. It's just, I don't know why this one, because you hit it on the head. And this is where, when you talked about when there's a vulnerability and, researchers will go out there and they'll release a POC for an exploit. Right. And I understand that. And I understand the need to understand how it works, especially some of the vulnerabilities that are released that are complicated. But I feel like this is simpler than that. And I don't know. I just, in my brain, I can't help but I can't shake this feeling of like, we're encouraging the bad guys more than we're encouraging the good guys to make change. And
well,
that Rainbow Table too, because I mean, think about this, right? So you're talking about, like you said, with the Rainbow Table, you have the password matched with the hash. It's easy for the lookup. It's NTLNV1. Blah 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 blah. We know this from just our practice. How many people reuse passwords?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, you're not, I think there's a piece of this that you're not just talking about, and I know this is not to all put it on like Google or Mandy. And I just, the topic is itself is really what, it's just, there's a lot there. Right. I just think it's a very debatable topic. I mean, not that it matters now, cause it's out there. Right. But it's just interesting. It's just interesting to think about, and folks should obviously consider getting themselves to more common protocols, but, consider other things in place too, especially with this. I think from my end, understanding how often people reuse passwords.
Well, I'm going to say the benefit though, is if someone releases a proof of concept or a vulnerability, usually a lot of those are even public facing in some ways. So it's like, how someone can actually start doing something. At least with this, you have to be in an environment first.
You have to be in. Yeah.
Which is, so you jump through enough steps and layers to get to that point. So I would say the risk may still present itself, but
it's behind the fence.
Yeah, like the exposure for finding bad has already presented itself too. So you're not like behind the eight ball, per se.
And I don't think I'm by any means the smartest person in the world, so hopefully when I say this, it's not creating new news. But I think with a lot of the stuff we know, like people, stolen creds, people who, I mean, we know anybody that has any type of, protection on their accounts or their users, their self, their identity, right? You get a lot of these places that are like, hey, this password's been identified out on this forum, blah, 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 blah. I could think how easy it would be to profile, and now I've issued a rainbow table of stuff, and then I can more easily profile given individuals. I can do a lot, pretty quick OSINT on a lot of folks to be able to find things, and I don't know, like enhancing that or increasing that or giving more of a full flood of that will just make that part easier, which I think will reduce the barrier to getting past that fence some. I just hope it. I hope that's not the case. I hope this goes in a direction I think Google Mandiant was trying to go.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if we look at all the upcoming events, if there could be anything related to potentially tied back to NTLMV1 being utilized in some way or fashion.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I'm off my soapbox. I had to play the devil's advocate on this one. I really did.
No, I mean, it's always good to think like about responsibility, because that, and when they talk about like bug releases, vulnerability releases, notifications, that's a really important thing, is like responsible disclosure that I think security, like, it's just that we should all care about it. Because it's too easy to find something that could really ruin a whole entire business because information is released irresponsibly that puts too many things at risk, which eventually could put people at risk as well. So that's always something that should be a consideration. Luckily I have a lot of trust in Mandiant. So I'm hoping that, you know, they're thinking about that when they have these conversations, and I'm sure they are.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the topic and what they're trying to accomplish is absolutely necessary. Yeah. I think moving away from that is, I think that's a no brainer. All right, Scott, what do you got next for us?
So the next one, I'm going to pivot to something a little more technical. And this one I just love this one because it just speaks volumes to, why we threat hunt, kind of how threat actors perform in a lot of ways, and how in a way things are hidden and yet very obvious at the same time. It's a Malwarebytes blog, and it's titled, "Can You Use Too Many Lol Bins to Drop Some Rats?" Basically, they're walking through how this attack unfolded that was dropping Remcos, which is a remote access Trojan, and Net Support Manager, which is a legitimate remote administration tool. But it's funny because they refer to it as a rat sometimes, like Net Support Rat, when it's used without authorization, essentially. But, you know, these types of tools give full remote desktop access. It's like you're remoting in. So you have full control of the file system. You can execute commands, keylogging, clipboard monitoring, different types of persistence. And you can even do some like tunneling and proxying for lateral movement. So usually when things like this are being delivered, they go through a multi-stage phishing or infection chains. They broke this down into multiple stages based on kind of like the effort. So they have the stage one, which is the initial access piece. This I found interesting because I remember seeing four files before, but it's not a common lol bin that comes up a lot. But they have the command where they're basically running four files, and four files, what it basically does is it's, you provide it a path, you provide it what you want to match on, and if it matches on something, it will run kind of like a scripted action, right? And so in this case, they did the four files for Windows System 32 is the path, and they looked for Notepad EXE. So if Notepad EXE exists in System 32, which we know it does, then it will initiate the command where it runs the command prompt to start MSHTA and basically load up the attacker web app. So what's great is it shows how you can use legitimate tools. You can chain things. And so a lot of times if the process chain for legitimate actions is really long, EDR stopped following that chain. And it also breaks up some detections in some ways. And when you're looking at something, it might not look bad initially. But we've talked about script interpreters chaining. So in this case, you'd have command prompt launching MSHTA. That's something that's just noteworthy in itself. Seeing four files run, I don't think it's that often of an execution that gets utilized, but with the command line for four files, you should see the command that's provided for what's supposed to execute if there are matches. And so it's really easy to, you know, quickly analyze what am I expecting to see and why is this running? So that was the initial access piece, right? That kind of started the execution. The stage two, so what was there? One, two, there's three little bins just in the initial access. Stage two, when MSHTA fetched that remote HTA file, it immediately spawned a command prompt, which then launched PowerShell, which then fed a command to curl. And then after it curled something, it made a directory. Then it used tar to basically untar what it pulled down because it was a PDF disguised as a PDF extension, but it really was a tar. And so when I unpacked that, it was a Trojanized real animation software executable that they used the command let invoke sim method, which is basically how you use WMI calls, especially in newer, because Windows, I don't know if they've completely ripped it out, but I know they're ripping out WMI with the exception of running it inside PowerShell, which gives you the ability to log WMI actions much better. But they use basically WMI to then create the process to run the Trojanized executable. So we had three little bins there, and then right into the stage two, you have one, two, three, four, technically, I guess, five little bins, if you think about invoke sim method. So a lot just to basically download and then stage. And then one of the things it does when it's doing the staging is that malicious Trojanized executable, it began writing partial files. So in Windows, it can create cab files, but it was breaking things up into dot parts of those, which is common for malware to kind of break things up. So it's even harder to analyze. And out of those part files, there was a cab file, there's a .dbs file, and there's a .bat file that look like were part of the parts. So then once that script is basically created, then it's using WScript for the to launch that VBS, which will silently spawn command prompt again, which will then run the bat file, which the bat file will then launch expand, which is another lull bin. And expand, that's when I mentioned there was a .cab file. Expand is a utility that's used to extract contents of a .cab archive. So that way it can basically unpack, and in this case, it's unpacking the net support rat and its helpers. And then, so in that step, what, there was one, two, three, four lull bins again. I didn't like keep track of the total count of how many lull bins were used entirely, but I mean, we're definitely over 10. And then for persistence, it did add a user init NPR logon script to the registry hive, which is the current user registry hive, which basically is when the user logs in that launches that client 32exe, which is the rat based on the directory and program data. So it's just always very interesting to see. I mean, it's just a very simple article. And what's nice is they show the command lines that are associated with it, so you can kind of understand how is the lull bin being used. Because some of the key indicators when you see lull bins is if you see lull bins used in your environment, we say lull bins. I mean, if you see basically a binary used in your environment that comes with the system, you can see how it's commonly used naturally. And sometimes when you see how attackers use it, there is a difference. So I like when they include all the arguments and things they're using. But you can also see how lull bins are leveraged to basically do every part of the attack and why people pay attention to these. And some of these lull bins are common enough you can't just make detections off of them. And that's why we threat hunt and we look for these behaviors and different pieces of these behaviors. Attackers can kind of pick and choose to build their attack path and their methods for how these little bins will be potentially used or these behaviors used for how they might set up their attack or things they know how to do. So that's why we always see this stuff kind of repeat a lot from attacker to attacker and attack to attack. So just a really cool brief article. It's definitely worth checking out. And it's good to line up. Do you have threat hunts for this kind of activity or detections for these types of activities at all? Because these are simple things that are easy to build on, right? So it doesn't take a lot of savvy technical wherewithal to figure this out. And so if you're definitely starting with threat hunting or detection engineering, it's just a good article to, you know, test your grid against what you already have and what you can create. So I liked it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. And not to lead in it too much, because this is definitely going to be a hot topic on next week's live show. But yeah, the low bin side is very interesting. And it makes me think, Scott, back to, you know, the old school days. And I wonder how prevalent it is in defenders' thinking and like your, you know, your analysts, your hunters, or who's out there looking at logs and trying to look for the bad. Remember, historically, we really tried to find those oddball things, right? Like we were really kind of trained and tuned early in the early years, at least for our careers, to look for that malware signature, right? Look for those things that stood out as odd. Mm-hmm. And the use of lull bins really is done nothing but become a baseline. And in leveraging that, what's on the system to accomplish the things to blend in the common activity. So I think the heavy leverage and example here of the leverage of lull bins really does lean into the defenders understanding how they function, making sure you understand what these things are doing, what it means when they're chaining, like they, like you've described here, or this article shows. Definitely something to consider. Also one of the things, so that user init MPR logon script registry edit, that's come up a couple times in the past few months. And I'm not saying that I have enough data to necessarily stand here and confidently say it's a trend. But it is a bit non-standard for the persistent side. And something that definitely, I think when I look at this, it's the first thing I put a big pin in, because I know it's not talked about enough. And just something new for us to really get our brains around understanding common activity from adversaries. But I love this one, Scott. I thought this was a good one you brought to the table, man.
Yeah, I hope people take the time to just check it out, because it really would be 5 minutes or less just to put their eyes on it and see everything. So
yeah, it's awesome how much is packed into, like, you know, a one page article. Like, not even, you know, it's so cool. It's very straightforward. But yeah, definitely give it a look.
All right, what do you have for us next?
All right, so another fun one. This one I thought was, I liked this because it, you know, it removes a bit of the sweat from the defender a little bit when you kind of consider some of the pieces that are brought up in this. But this is an article from CyberArk. It's called Uno Reverse Card, Stealing Cookies from the Cookie Stealers. So CyberArk Labs researchers kind of turned the tables on the malware as a service called SteelC, which is a cookie credential stealer, by exploiting a weakness in the attacker's own infrastructure. So by abusing a simple cross-site scripting flaw in a leaked SteelC operator web panel, researchers were able to interact with the attacker's back end and extract the session cookies, earning the blog its Uno Reverse Card title there. The work highlights how rushed or insecure criminal infrastructure, despite being designed by the attackers, can still expose operational details and artifacts that defenders can leverage for insight. This research not only gave defenders kind of a rare peek inside, like, an active info stealer operation, but it also yielded some interesting fingerprints and active session control over SteelC operator sessions themselves. So SteelC, just for some context, the InfraSteel operates under a malware as a service model, and it has a web panel interface used by operators to manage stolen credentials and run campaigns through. It's circulated since 2023, I believe, and collects cookies, passwords, other sensitive session data from infected systems. So the web panel leak as an entry point, this happened in spring of 2025. The SteelC panel source code was leaked shortly after a major version 2 release, which was what enabled the researchers to analyze that backend. So a straightforward stored cross-site script in the panel allowed researchers to inject payloads that captured critical data, including active session cookies and operator environment details,
directly from that SteelC infrastructure. Using that cross-site script exploit, CyberArk obtained system fingerprints such as the hardware, the supported languages, time zone, and attributed to a specific SteelC operator dubbed YouTube TA. Despite SteelC being the theft of cookies, its own platform lacked those basic protections, like HTTP only flags, as an example, to prevent defensive theft of its own sessions, which is just, it's fun. The panel contained logs showing over 390,000 stolen passwords and 3 million cookies. But most of those cookies were mostly identified as non-sensitive tracking cookies, of course. All of this was sitting in their infrastructure, collected from victims, you know, really illustrating the scale of their operation, or giving at least the suggestion to the scale. Analysis suggests operators may be using old or compromised YouTube channels to spread malware samples by luring users seeking cracked software, demonstrating that social engineering distribution synergy with that InfoStealer campaign. But all in all, Scott, I just really thought this was fun. And there was, you know, we have stories that we could tell and go on for plenty about kind of sort of the hacking back, or, you know, challenging the attempted campaign or the attempted social engineering, and different things like that that me and you have experienced together. But I love seeing this because I thought it was a cool flip. It was nice to kind of see the attackers are human too, and they're flawed just like we are on our side, right? And it exists on both ends. And, you know, the defenders are generally stressed about making sure that we protect the environments that we control and identify the bad in our place. But you have to wonder, how often are the attackers consider defending their own stuff, right? Just like on our side, how often are we consider attacking back, right? So it's just a really cool dynamic. I thought it was an interesting operation. I loved what CyberArk did here. It was really cool what they found. But yeah, you know, what did you think about this one, Scott?
No, I think stuff like this is funny, and it's good. It's good to note, though, that, I mean, this is put out by CyberArk, which is a bigger company. And I'm almost certain that when they started finding some of these things, they probably have already channels to law enforcement and stuff. So depending on what country you reside in, even if you're going after people who are doing bad things, but you could still be charged with basically inappropriate computer use and hacking kind of thing. So be careful when you find things like this. If you do happen to just be curious and you're poking around and you do find something, sometimes it's good at that moment to take pause and maybe figure out how to reach out and say, hey, I think I have something about X, just to cover your bases. I have, great, from my experience working with like FBI and other folks, they're usually pretty easy to work with. You explain things, they're interested, they're not trying to get in your way unless there's like, you know, if there's like a pending investigation and they already know this and they're like, please stop, we don't want you to like alert them that this is a problem because we're leveraging this. I mean, there's stuff like that that could happen, and they may not tell you that specifically, but if they tell you they need you to stop your activity, think of that use case as possibly why, like they already know and they've already kind of been using that. So you don't want to go any further to put that investigation at risk. But if it is net new information, they're always very appreciative. If there's anything, they might kind of let you go further in some ways, or they might say, I appreciate it, but we'll try to take it from here and then we'll reach out if we have any questions or want, you know, whatever. And so, you know, be thinking about those things. But yeah, when it comes to security practitioners, both offensive and defensive, we're not the best at IT, if that makes any sense, because we're really good at understanding the problems. Sometimes we're not really good at implementing solutions. And this is a good example of that, because I can tell you, oh, well, for instance, when we talked about NTLM V1, it's easy to say, well, we need to turn that off. But it's much harder to say, well, if we need it, how do we do it securely potentially? Or is there an option to just turn it off, or do you have to do a bunch of other things to actually disable it, right? Like there's all those caveats that sometimes we don't, as security people, know if you were to task us with that, to go do that. We're fully capable and typically smart enough to do our own research and basically figure it out. But it's not like native knowledge a lot of times, some of the IT stuff. Now, it's different if you kind of grew up in IT for a long time before becoming a security practitioner. But for some reason, it always feels like when you switch over to security practitioner from IT, it's like your IT knowledge now is like stops, right? So when you kind of become that old guy that's like, back in my day, and things have changed so much in technology that you're not really current anymore. So even though you have knowledge, it might not be as relevant as you think. So as security practitioners, we always have to make sure to keep our ego out of it, especially when working with IT. But yeah, getting back to this, I think it's great information to be able to pull that they were able to collect, because not only when I mentioned law enforcement to protect yourself, some of the information that you can actually track down the identities of people, where they're potentially physically located, all those types of things, that's information they can use to actually do something about it, right? Like a lot of times if we were, say, we're able to hack the hacker, you know, what does that mean? Does that mean you can steal the information they have? Does that mean you can shut down their infrastructure? That's not really like stopping them. It's more like inconveniencing them in a lot of ways. And you can maybe inconvenience them enough where they just give up. But if you really are looking to actually punish the individuals, law enforcement kind of has to be part of that chain anyways. But the details they describe here, I think, are very beneficial for law enforcement. So, yeah.
Yeah, just to echo that a little bit, Scott, because I think it's important. In my experience as well, working with authorities when it comes to stuff like that, or reaching out to bigger players, people that are in position to, you know, to better handle the things you might find in those areas, has always been fruitful from what I've experienced. I think that collaboration piece is huge. So I think I just wanted to make sure I expanded on that just a little bit for everyone out there, that you mentioned kind of that, what I believe to be a bit of the human flaws when we lose control of our ego. It's great to have those finds. It's awesome to be a passionate practitioner. But there are times when it's time to, you know, call in the dogs, or, you know, collaborate with a partner, or move to a place where you can actually have a broader scale impact, right? And you can make sure that you keep yourself protected, which I think is even more important too, because you can find your way down that rabbit hole and get yourself into some trouble if you're not careful. So good point, Scott. I just want to make sure I echoed it.
Yeah. And the other thing I'd probably add is, I know some organizations are always fearful to like reaching out or having that open dialogue with, you know, FBI or other type of government agencies. And I can understand some of the hesitation there, but I know specifically working with the FBI, they really, really try hard to tie that if there is an incident or something you're dealing with, their job is not to like hold you accountable for fines and things. That's not their role. So when people are like, well, this is going to get public, they won't publicly release things. And if they, for whatever reason, were going to, they have to have your authorization. So, you know, those fears and reservations that sometimes get brought up with like leadership and management that don't understand that relationship, it's worth having that conversation. And they do a good job explaining that too, to prepare your company or business and industries. It's a good thing to have in your back pocket, a good resource.
Yeah, 100%. In my experience, and I can speak at least to the FBI piece, and I know there's folks out there with a lot of other different entities that are listening that have a lot of different other entities depending on where they're located. Mm-hmm. But from my experience, that every time I've worked with the cyber teams on that side, it's been fantastic. It's been fantastic collaboration, and it's always been positive. And I think it's worth noting, because it's hopefully it encourages people to, you know, to feel safe reaching out and doing that stuff when it comes to this, the cyber defense side. Is there guys just like us? Everything I've ran across, there's practitioners like us trying to defend, which has been awesome. So
they're out. Better with the more we work together. So it's just the thing.
100%. All right. It's last on the docket this week, Scott.
So similar to the same thing I mentioned earlier, that cybersecurity people are just not good at IT. This is just a basic article from Bleeping Computer. But it's called Hackers Exploit Security Testing Apps to Breach Fortune 500 Firms. And basically, there are, you know, web applications that are intentionally used for exploitation. They're misconfigured on purpose, and they're used for security training and internal penetration testing and the likes, such as DVWA, OWASP Juice Shop, there's the Hackathon, there's BWAP. And what's interesting, though, is what was discovered is where companies and likely these cyber teams or penetration teams has set these things up. They set them up in a manner that opened them up potentially to the internet, and they're intentionally vulnerable, so they're really easy to take advantage of. In a lot of cases, they found, I think, like 1,926 live vulnerable applications exposed this way. And often they're linked to overprivileged identity access and management roles. So that means whatever set them up or whatever identities existed elsewhere or had privileges to do other things. And then these things were deployed in AWS, the Google Cloud, Azure. So now you have even bigger exposure. And then there's a lot of like potential lateral or adjacent things that could be potentially accessed. There was not really least privilege practices found. There's a lot of default credentials being used. So you can see how this kind of like Pandora's box opening up, right? Because you basically put out this very vulnerable thing that's supposed to be compromised. And sure enough, things were discovered and were compromised. So for instance, out of the 616 DVWA instances, 20% of those are found to have artifacts deployed by malicious actors. A lot of it had to do with cryptocurrency mining, because there's a lot of, if you're looking for this low hanging vulnerabilities, a lot of groups just have scanners finding those things, automatically deploying crypto miners. So there is the XM rig tool was common in a lot of these breaches. They even had, they found some advanced persistent mechanisms. They say advanced, but basically they had a watchdog, a bash script that when it was deleted, it would restore itself from a base64 encoded backup. So they had a little more hooks there, and the XM rig stuff was being pulled from GitHub. And the other thing about having these like pre-built web app vulnerable type stuff is you'd imagine you're putting this out there for training. There might not be the same level, especially if you're the training is more offensive and things. Might not be the same level of monitoring on this stuff. So now you have like an open-ended access that if someone were to leverage and then gain more access, you're kind of doing that. Well, what do I, for my instant response piece, what am I doing to understand how this even happened? It might be hard to track that down. So there was just an interesting article that kind of, I thought, played well with what you were finding with the attackers poorly setting stuff up. In this case, like I said, security people, they had good intentions, but they didn't do this in a way that was best fit for the organization, best fit from like best practice. And it's hard when you're trying to make something vulnerable, but you're trying to do best practice. But, you know, usually the typical thing is, anytime you're trying to make something vulnerable for testing, least privilege for a lot of things, or just, you know, orphaned privileges, right? Like privileges that don't work anywhere else, and or isolation, right? Those are big moves for any kind of a lab environment. If anyone's ever set up a lab, those are often how you want to set them up. You don't want your lab living with your basically production environment. When we set up a lab, we were thinking through all those things and thinking how we could access it, or what does that look like? And we had a lot of isolation pieces as well and had to think through those processes. So it's really just thinking about how we might be really good at security, but we're not necessarily good at IT. So one of those.
Yeah, not to, because there's information I don't know here. So the soapbox I'm going to jump on for a second here, maybe a moot point, but when I see that, kind of all the least privileges, IAM exposure, leveraging those credentials that are just existing, I can't help but think or wonder if a lot of the accounts that are there are like, because cloud, IAM access control piece and cloud, it is kind of relatively new, right? And it's only been a handful of years to where it's really kind of snowballed into common practice to leverage these things. And I also think about a lot of people, how they are still, even now, shifting into that cloud infrastructure. And the setups in those tend to be very different than what legacy setups are, especially for access control, right? So there's nested privileges, there's nested roles that do things in different ways. There's roles that at least legacy. I'm not sure if some of that's changed, but in, early environments where you would give a role for a specific thing you needed to accomplish and you're moving at speed to market type pace, and that role might not clearly, like the IT person on the side that's setting it up might not understand that it's also letting you have these other things.
Yeah.
So I can't help but wonder how much of that might be just sitting out there that's still being leveraged, because I think there's an evolution to those infrastructures. And I think some people know it really well. I think some people that are transitioning into it, they're going through that phase of trying to learn and understand it. It's a different frame of thought. It is a bit of a different thinking, right? Like, I think just as an example, leveraging IAM like towards the Azure side, when you're thinking about shifting a lot of your infrastructure away from like on-prem AD type things up into the cloud, it's not the same. It's different. And there are these different pieces to consider. So I can't help but wonder how much of that is actually what's being leveraged here, if at all. And I could be way off, but it's the first thought I have when I see this, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, the cloud, what's interesting about the cloud is there's a lot of things that it doesn't necessarily hide from you, but it gives you a false sense of control.
Yes.
Because everything is presented, especially when you think about access, they try to make it very easy to try to put things in buckets so that you can use the cloud effectively. And by doing so, when you look at the tool tips and look at and follow the flow of things that are just created by default, you'll see things, and those things are created to make sure things will work, but may not work exactly how you want them to work. And so someone who's technical understands what they see from like the GUI interface and the cloud, but they don't dig in or have the back end knowledge of these things, will make a lot of assumptions that oftentimes are misleading. And I think that's why we run into a lot of like the cloud breaches that we do have, because that kind of false sense of expertise that you feel when you're kind of using their tooltips and their help guides, right, to get things up and running. Because they're pretty good at why, if you ever get in any cloud environment, you want to spin something up for the first time, it pretty much hand feeds you, oh, once you do this, go here, do this. Do you need to do that? I mean, like, it's just like that easy. But that's to get things working. That's not to gets things like production ready or the most secure or any of that kind of stuff, because security is sometimes application specific, environment specific. It's not just blanket security specific, right? So I think that's why they kind of fall into that, just you don't know what you don't know. And not saying that people set these things up are like incompetent, right? Because they could, like I said, have had a great IT background, just not a lot of cloud experience. So their understanding is they know what they need to know and they see what they think they need to see, but it's not the whole picture.
Right. Yeah. And I remember experiencing things on the other side of that too. Like I don't think it's lack of capability, intelligence or ability in general. I think it's just very different. And I remember times myself, this is years ago and I'm sure some of it's changed, but
you know, trying to migrate to the cloud for certain things. You know, I need to be able to do X, Y, and Z. And I have privileges to do X and Y, but I also need to do Z. But by adding this additional privilege to let me do Z, it also lets me do A, B, C, and D.
Yeah.
And you don't need that, but it's not necessarily easily controllable or modifiable. So then it's just something you have to understand and consider to the, you know, to the weight or the value, just like you would consider how many people have full domain access type of stuff, right?
Yeah. But I also feel like it's like that early teen mentality where like you finally got smart in your career. So you feel like you know enough, and then you don't know what you don't know. So there's nothing to challenge how smart you really are, how much you know about a specific topic. And so that sometimes puts you in that situation where you're thinking through everything correctly as far as you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just the evolution of adopting the new technology, right?
Yeah. It happens every single time. That's like the worst case too. A lot of times when there's new technology that rolls out, I mean, like we can go on so many tangents with this, but if you can just think about early versions of LLMs and ChatGPT and things, some of that stuff was put out there with less guardrails so that people can help define those by finding the issues versus trying to define them early. And in some instances, that's good. Maybe in some instances, that's probably not good. But very oftentimes, it's almost like product is ready. We can't think of all the problems. So the first iterations are going to be learning curves for everybody.
Right. Speed to market, and then not considering that the attacker's looking glass is literally to find those things, like look for those flaws in your process.
Yeah. So cool. One thing to mention, you kind of brought it up a little earlier, but we have our year-end review, the 2025 trends and what's next. Live podcast happening, but next Thursday, right?
Thursday, yeah. It's going to be, I think it's going to be a good conversation, Scott. I'm really looking forward to that because we can kind of like talk about what we've seen over the past year, but really kind of like forecast forward to see what we, you know, what we think from our position currently, what we should really kind of be considering, thinking about, and almost trying to aim towards that proactive thinking conversation, right?
Yeah. So that'll happen Thursday the 29th, and that'll be from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So it's live, so people can join in the conversation. I'd love to hear what other people maybe have experienced in 2025, if they want to chime in or if the things we talk about definitely align with what people see too. Yeah, getting that feedback live is also good and confirming for what we're doing. But for that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing back up next week with our live podcast. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of January 19th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.